Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Poddleters. I hope that you're doing well. I've decided that my intros are a bit too boring and a bit stiff, so I want to have a bit more fun in the introduction, and maybe that is because this episode is very funny, very silly, but also gets quite serious. I speak to Jamie Windust, who is the contributing editor at Gay Times. They're also now an author. Their debut book, In Their Shoes, has just come out. So we talk about that, but then I did also want to add in a trigger warning because we do talk about sexual assault and things pertaining to that kind of thing towards the end of the issue. So if you think that that might be something triggering for you or potentially upsetting, then maybe don't listen, although it's probably about halfway through, so you could maybe listen to the beginning bit. But yeah, I hope that you're all doing very well and, you know, surviving and thriving in this weird but wonderful time. And I really hope that you enjoy this episode, as always, with the wonderful Jamie Windust. And if you wouldn't mind, please do rate, review and subscribe. It really helps other people to find the podcast, helps me to get amazing guests. And hopefully it all comes around in one wonderful circle where we're all learning and loving and lolling together. Okay, bye.
Hello and welcome to Adulting. Today I'm joined by Jamie Windust.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. Yes, I'm back. Thank you very much.
Yes. This is your second appearance, and I was just saying I keep wanting to go Jemay because the Jemay private school girl, but you're
and
actually not
it.
Tell us who you are, because you're not Jemay, you are Jemay.
Unfortunately, my whole career has not been a Chris Lilley impersonation. I'm Jamie Windust. I am a author, editor and model, and do you know what I added onto my list of things the other day? Cultural commentator, because I think it sounds professional.
I love that. I thought you were going to say cultural icon.
I mean, if the shoe fits. I don't know.
I really thought that's where you were going to go with that. I was like, okay. So ready for it. So author's new.
Author is new. I mean, dependent on when you are listening to this, that could be a mild lie.
That's true.
Yes, author, a book has been released from my brain.
But is it, it's not ready to, well, you can buy it, but it's not out yet, is it?
Indeed. So here's the plug, brace for impact. In Their Shoes, my debut book, is out on the 21st of October. So dependent on when you are listening, you can either pre-order is available now, or you can told on down to your local Waterstones and harass them for a copy.
Love. So how has your lockdown been, and when did you actually finish writing? So I feel like, did you start writing last year? Was it when you went to Brighton? Was that when you were writing? Have I just made that up?
Thank you for your intrinsic knowledge of my life. You know what? You're also one of those people that I have a very select memory for. Like, for example, you went to that charity shop near King's Cross and did something that I now, every time I'm in King's Cross, I'm like, I need to find that charity shop.
Oh my God, yeah, you do. It's really good.
Yeah, I just love that we have very select memories of each other. But yes,
yes,
that
so
is
specific.
True. I wrote this book from January last year to the end of the year. So I had a full 365 days to produce a book, correct? And it was a lot. I didn't actually start until April because I was like, how do you expect me to write a book? I do not understand. Because the process is normally they're very relaxed, I found, in the literary world. Very relaxed. They're like, yeah, just start. And I'm like, what do you mean? a mild tip from me to you, listener, is if you are thinking of writing a book, don't start at the start, because that's obviously the hardest bit. So I just started slap bang in the middle. Why not?
Love that. It sounds a bit like you're on a plane. I wonder if it was actually better without headphones. It sounds like you're flying through the air.
Oh my God, should I take them out?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, hold on. Right.
Oh. Oh, that's so much better.
I apologize, dearly. Right, I'm sat down now. I'm on the sofa. I'm relaxed.
Oh, this is so much better. It literally sounded like we were in, you know, in Spy Kids, the movie, when they go underwater in that like little tank thing. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do look like Spy Kids.
I love Spy Kids. It's one of my favourite films. But so how did you, why April? Because I feel like that was when we were in the throes of lockdown. How did you find that an inspiring moment to suddenly start picking out bits from your brain?
Oh, plot twist. This was April last year.
Oh, of course. Sorry. Correct. A different April. It was a different time.
You know what? It was a different time. I really didn't know where to start. And the book basically is, it's chronological in a sense, but it is very much chopped up into chapters, like most books. But each chapter is about a different segment of my life. So, for example, it was quite easy to just be like, I'm just going to start on the fashion chapter, or I'm going to start on the relationships chapter, and then figure out what that tone of voice was in that chapter, and then just kind of replicate throughout. But I'd say that my writing style is very much how I talk, so it was quite easy. I just kind of wrote in quite a silly, conversational, chatty, crude way.
Did you get self-conscious about writing? Because when I at the beginning of the year was also thinking about writing a book, and also the same as you, where they're just like, just start writing, and you're like, I don't understand, I don't know how to write a book, I don't know what you want from me, what do you want from me? But I got really self-conscious about the way that I was writing, and then it became really convoluted, and I was like going over every sentence trying to make it like the most amazing sentence from the New Yorker that you'd ever read, and it just absolutely fried my brain, and then I just gave up.
Absolutely. Do you know what? I've done that now. I've just written a piece. I've written quite an emotional piece for the next issue of Gay Times. And when I was writing it, and I had this also with the book, when I was writing something like meaningful, or like if I wanted to make like a very stern, like poignant moment, I was like, come on, Jamie, get that thesaurus out. Channel Dolly Alderton and like make people cry. And sometimes it's a lot harder than you think, but what I found was the best moments in the book are where I've just written and not stopped, and then read it back over it and have been, actually, that's very, if I do say so myself, that's very moving.
No, I agree though. It's like the best writing is stuff that's like uncomplicated and it feels natural. And it's actually like when you're, I think it's when you're aware of writing, like what you just said then is so true. When you're writing, really just it's flowing, it's just coming out of you and you're not really thinking about it, that reads so well. But it's when you're really focused on like, I'm going to make this sound so good, that you read it back and it's all like disjointed and really clunky and it's just crap.
Yeah, because I always try, my one thing is I always try and do, when I try and be like fancy, I try and throw in like a very funny but meaningful metaphor. And then I'll end up sitting there for like 2 hours, like, come on, think of a really great metaphor. And I'm like, it's not coming. It's not going to happen. My favourite line in the book is about the ones where I'm just like being silly and talking about just nonsense. And they're actually the best bits that I that I enjoy rereading as I sit every evening and reread my own book.
So how revealing is it? Is it, how much of it is like, is it memoir? Is it commentary? What's the real like crux of the book that you're getting, you want to get out there?
Mm-hmm. So the kind of general idea of the book is that it's my story of how I navigated being non-binary and how I am still navigating it.
So it is kind of a memoir in style. So it's very anecdotal. Each chapter has lots of, has kind of like a main story of an experience that I've faced relating to that topic. So like in relationships, we've got my one and only ever relationship. And then in fact, I've got like the first time that I ever tried on fancy clothes and like my relationship at the very beginning with fashion. And then it gets a bit darker. We've got like chapters on allyship and prejudice where I kind of detail things that have gone on and kind of it's very story focused, but each chapter has advice, each chapter has commentary at the end about kind of the wider landscape for trans people, because I was very aware that obviously my story is my story and my story does not fit everyone. So it has lots of moments in it that I hope are applicable to lots of different people. And I think also one thing that I've found is that it is actually, hopefully, relatable to people of all genders. You don't have to be trans to enjoy the book, because a lot of the takeaways in it are about just freedom of self-expression, which is not assigned to any one gender.
I feel like even in the time since we last spoke on the podcast, you've changed from leopard print elephant to Jamie Windus. And I feel like in terms of self-expression, you seem so you and so much more comfortable in who you are and really being yourself. I mean, I'm talking about online, so I don't know. But do you feel like this was the right time for you to write this book? I just feel like you come across as so much more confident and certain in being able to be Jamie. Do you feel that way?
I do. You know what I mean? Do you know what? I was in, speaking of leopard elephant, she who should not be named, I was in a shoe shop the other day, and someone came up to me and said, she was like, oh, I followed you since you were a leopard elephant. And I just put my hand on her back and I was like, I'm so sorry. I was like, you deserve a lifetime achievement award for having to witness that period of time. I do feel a lot more confident. I do feel a lot more self-assured. And I think that in part comes with feeling like my career and my jobs are very much more grounded in structure now. I'm an author. I'm a contributing editor at Gay Times. Like a lot of things have set in place, as it were. So I feel a lot more grounded. I feel a lot more confident in my work, which then seeps into kind of me as a person. And also aesthetically, I've changed quite a lot. You might not believe this now, dear listener, slash Anoni, but I am not wearing a lot of makeup.
Which, oh my God, j'adore.
If you told me, you know, you saw me last time, I was painted for about 10 people. So that has been really interesting to acclimatise to a new aesthetic, emphasis on the ass. And yeah, I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
You always had your same, face look that you would do, whereas now you do like loads of different looks and sometimes you go au natural. I've actually started wearing more makeup just because YOLO.
Are you like in mourning for me? So you're like, right, Jamie's not wearing a lot, so to counteract this, I'm gonna wear all of the makeup that Jamie once wore.
It's just so addictive. Like I started putting, like it's happened slowly by slowly, but like I started wearing eyeshadow and then I was like, oh, I can wear eyeliner. And then it's like, once you know how nice you can look, it's really hard to not try and do that every day. And I'm like, yeah, my face looks fine without makeup. But then if you take a picture, like it just looks so much better. I'm actually going to try and stop doing it because it's like, I'm like addicted to wearing foundation even when my skin's good. And it really annoys me because I'm like, just let your skin breathe in the air.
I started wearing like no makeup, and then I was like, oh no, we can dabble with a little bit of concealer here and there. And then in the months since then, I've now my now natural makeup is obviously foundation, bronzer, highlight, powder, which for me, oh, voice break there. Yes, I am. for me, that's not a lot of makeup, but for, you know, maybe a regular Joe or Joanne, it's still quite a lot of makeup, but you know, it's all right.
That's like a natural look. It's not like a, you know, wham bam glam mam.
Yeah, and it means that when I do wham bam glam mam, it's very, I enjoy it a bit more. It feels like more of a treat, almost.
Yes, this is my problem. I feel like I don't know where to go next because I'm so basic. Like, I'm like a brown eyeshadow or a pink eyeshadow, and I haven't really gone any further than that. So this is what keeps happening to me when I go on a night out. Not that I'm going on nights out at the minute, but in life, I can't go any further than I've already gone. I need to like get more experimental.
Have you ever heard of blush?
As in crazy, as in the blusher, or is it a thing?
Yes, it's a very new trend. I don't think many people are doing it, and it's called wearing lots of blush. I think you'd look great with blush.
It's so funny you said that. Yesterday, for the first time, I got something like a creaming blusher, but it was like a peachy one, and it did look really good. But the thing is, because I go so red anyway when I get embarrassed, I was always quite scared of blusher because I spent my whole life trying to like de-red my face. So the idea of like putting on something that would make my face pink when I've spent my whole childhood being mortified by like how red I would go, it seems quite alien to me.
I mean, well, peach is a good shout. However, I have to get something off my chest. You could call this an adulting exclusive if you care. I hate cream blush. I've said it. I mean,
why
I look,
is that?
No, it, for me, it doesn't work because I wear so much. When I do my face, I wear so much foundation that if I was to put cream blush on, it would just, I'd have to put the whole pot on for it to come through. Because obviously I wear too much blush. There we go, I've said it. On people like you, my love, a nice little dabble on the apples of cream blush. Chef's kiss.
Well, so what happens with me with the powder is for some reason, powder just sits on my, you can just see the powder. It must be something to do with my skin type. Like it doesn't look good. I always want to do a powder contour because I feel like you can get like a sharper definition. But whenever I do that, it just doesn't work. So all of my makeup is cream, like including my bronzer.
Whoa, that's risky.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of
powder. I know. It is unusual, I'll take that, but it's just how I roll.
You're so cuckoo.
I know, you've never met anyone less basic. So in terms of with the non-binary aspect of life, the media and the world, it's quite a tricky terrain right now. Are you feeling like, how are you feeling in yourself? I mean, on top of lockdown and being in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah, you know, I heard about this pandemic from a friend. I hadn't actually noticed it was going on. I'm joking. That's very insensitive.
Oh my God, Scott, wait, my doorbell's just gone. Wait, stay there. BRB. Love it. 1 second, honey.
Hello there. It is I, Jamie Windhurst. Whoever is listening to this, I would just like to let you know that Anoni has gone to get the doorbell. What do we think?
Oh my God, I'm so sauce. So I specifically said to leave it outside the door because I didn't want them to ring the doorbell. And then they just rang the doorbell anyway.
Rude. I mean, again, me and you, peas in a pod, because I am also waiting for a delivery. And I put a little note outside saying, on the phone, please leave here. So let's see. They follow instructions.
What have you? What is your package?
Thank you for asking. I have, influenced the life. I'm sure I can predict that whatever just arrived, you also did not pay for. I'm getting some new clobber and clobber clothes.
Oh, nice. I like Zalando. Yeah, I don't actually know what my package is either. I don't actually know what it is gifting. But you know when you just get a tracking link and you don't know what it is? And then they're just like, when would you like this to be delivered? I just have no idea what it is.
I think you would benefit from this as well. My dear friend, Oliver, off of Oliver Bonus. I'm making myself laugh this morning. he does great stuff. They very kindly gifted me stuff for my new flat. I'm basically living in a show.
Oh my God, stop. You can hit me up with that email once we finish recording.
Absolutely. Yeah, because you've just moved. Come on, here we go. All makes sense.
Where are you living now? Is that classified information?
You know, it may be classified information, but like my late mother, Princess Diana, I'm not afraid of the paparazzi. So I currently reside in Wimbledon. Do come and find me if you dare. But yeah,
I'm going to come and find you.
Go on, dare you.
I'm going to come and find you. But where have you always been south?
I've always been south, but I've been living. I finally moved out on my own in July, and it honestly is the best thing that's ever happened.
Oh my God, living on your own is amazing. I mean, I've just moved in with my boyfriend, so that's really rude to say, but it feels like living on my own, living with him, because it's kind of like, it's different from living with a flatmate, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And is it because you just pretend he's not there the whole time?
Well, he's actually going into the office at the minute, so he's actually not here in the day. And also, we both like our own space, so we're really good at being together, but not actually. So we just like sit together and read, like losers.
Now, I'm going to have to say this because I've been meaning to say it for a long time. How, when your boyfriend has the face that he has, how can you just sit there and read? I'm sorry, I don't understand.
To be fair, I do sometimes get distracted by his cheekbones. They're really, like, they're amazing, but I'm just offended for my own cheeks because his are so sharp. It's really upsetting. But also, I have known him for, like, over 10 years. So you just, it kind of, like, you get used to the face.
It's his attractiveness is now numb to you.
No, like this morning when he was getting ready for work, I was like, shit, you're so hot. But and I was lying in bed like, wow, you really do look great. So it's not it doesn't wear off, but you're just kind of like, you do take it for granted. I do think that sometimes I'm like, shit, I'm really taking this for granted. He is really hot. He also has a great personality. Just want to put that in there before we objectify him too much.
He's on my list of people that it's not a physical list, it's just a mental list of people that if I ever met, I would not be able to react. For example, this happened the other day. I went to a dinner party for the first time in my life, and it was in North London. So I'm sure you can imagine the caliber of people, no offense. But it was a very posh affair, okay? Very posh. And there's a guy there that I had said to the person whose dinner party it was, I was like, if this guy comes, you need to let me know because I need to prepare myself, not with a razor, but just mentally. Need to prepare. And he tapped me on the shoulder and I didn't know he was there, turned around and I just went, Christ, your eyes. And then immediately felt embarrassed. And then, you know, when you just have word from it, I was like, he was talking to me and I was like, I'm so sorry, but I'm distracted by your face. And then he kind of laughed and then just like didn't talk to me again. So
is it someone famous or is it someone I would know?
Unfortunately, it is not someone famous. He does look like, though, he does look like a grown-up version of the boy from Love Actually.
Oh, love that. Cute. Is that your type?
Good evening. Do apologise for my actions on the night of Saturday. However, I'm an author now, so come on down.
That's the thing. I know that you actually are like a professional journalist and you have some like more highbrow layers to your name than influencer. But when you're an author, it really changes the caliber of person that you are. And you kind of can It's just so much more grown up. Like, I'm hashtag gel.
It does feel very grown up. And also, it feels very grown up to have that as well as contributing editor. Like, the other day, I don't mind telling you, Anoni, I was on the news to talk about trans stuff. And they were like, what would you like us to put as your title? And I was like, God, I can put contributing editor now. That feels very official. So yeah, it is quite nice to have titles, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I just say podcaster. I hate saying influencer. I just think it's a bit cringe. Sometimes I just make stuff up. So I've like upgraded from podcaster. I just say I'm a presenter. But then people think I'm on TV and I'm not. I have to be like, oh, just a little old show you might not have heard of. But one day we'll get there. I think I have good faith.
Absolutely. Like, cultural commentator is an upgrade from basically just being, it's basically just saying, I have opinions on the world. Who doesn't? everyone's a bloody cultural commentator. But, you know, it just sounds quite nice, doesn't it?
So what are your cultural commentating comments for me today? What are you thinking about the world? Anything in particular that you wanted to comment on?
I'd like to comment on the price of oat milk. Outrageous. Mm-hmm. What serious things should we discuss? I think at the moment, the pandemic is causing us a bit of a ruckus.
A little bit.
I feel like, I don't know if this is relevant for the listeners, but does anyone else, and I understand I can't hear your responses, but is anyone else just kind of a bit like, so confused by everything at the moment that we're kind of like, we don't have any idea what's going on. So we're just kind of like bumbling around. Still trying to be careful, still mildly aware of what's going on, but just like also having absolutely no idea.
Totally. And I feel like there's this weird thing where I'm following like what the rules say, as in like I'm socially distanced, but I have gone on holiday and I've like gone to restaurants but socially distanced. And I'm like, well, I'm doing what it says we're supposed to be doing. But then other people who perhaps are more anxious or shielding are then like, no, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. So then you feel really guilty because you're like, oh, okay. And you don't know who to listen to. And I'm not really sure what we're supposed to be doing and what's going on. Because even if you do what the government says, for other people, that's maybe not like enough of what you should be doing. So I feel a bit confused about what's happening as well.
I agree. I think that's right. I think it's about just using your brain a little bit sometimes. Because obviously, you know, I went out for dinner. I love a dinner on my own. So when Eat Out to Help Out came, I actually went to my local, this is not sponsored, my local Bill's, or as I like to call it, Williams. Just to have it fancy. So much in Eat Out to Help Out on my own that I am now good friends with the manager. Very good friends with the manager. Giorgio, if you're listening, hi. I'll have the calamari to go. Thank you.
I was just about to ask, what is actually, I did go there and Eat Out to Help Out, but on the extended version, Matt and I went for a lunch. What's your order from Bill's?
Now, brace for impact. I'm one of those people that I sit down and they know exactly what I want. Stop. So I have, with any hot meal, I always have a pot of tea. We start with the stone-baked bread. We go in for the tuna, which is like, you know when they do like raw tuna?
Tuna tartare. Kind
of like,
no?
Tuna tartare. Yeah, oui. And then if it's a Wednesday, we'll have a sirloin. If it's not a Wednesday, we'll have fish pie. And then we end on what they describe as lemon meringue pie in a glass, which is like a lemon cheesecake / lemon meringue pie hybrid in a tumbler glass. It's ideal.
So you have, why do you have sirloin on Wednesdays? Is it like Mean Girls when they're like, on Wednesdays we wear pink? You're like, on Wednesdays I eat meat.
On Wednesdays I eat cow. that's the pull quote. That's what we're taking out. Thank you. On Wednesdays I eat cow because it's a treat. And also, it's the last day of the Eat Out to Help Out. So I...
It's Wednesday today.
Shit.
Oh, you're so right. I forget. I always kept forgetting. But we did really rinse that a bit too much to the point where we weren't actually saving any money. Because you're like, no, shit, yeah, you get 50% off.
It came. The bill came and I was expecting it to be like £2. And it came and I was like, well, because I knew I was getting a discount, I ordered so much more food than I normally would order. So now it's just the price of a normal meal.
Oh, it's always so classic. That's what I do. It's like talking about gifting. So if I get gifted something that's worth £50, in my head I'm like, I've just saved £50, even though I didn't ask for it and nor has anyone given me £50 in money. So I definitely haven't saved it. So then I will think, oh, well, this thing costs £100. I can buy that. It's basically like having £50 off. So, and then Matt's like, this is not how maths works. But in my mind, it makes complete sense.
That's like, so get your extension lead out because I'm about to plug. We, in the book, there was, I speak about fashion quite a lot. And I always have that mentality with fashion. So like, for example, I bought my first ever pair a couple of weeks ago. Of designer shoes. Thank you very much, everyone. Don't worry, it was only at Bicester Village, so it was the outlet. but have you ever been to Bicester Village, by the way?
Oh my god, yeah. I used to go there all the time when I was younger. It was literally like my mum's favourite weekend out.
Olive.
That's what we do as children. When other people went to like centre parks, our mum be like, come on girls, we're going to Bicester Village.
Your mum is a legend, by the way. Can I just say that?
Oh, she so is. She is just the best person in the world.
If there ever was the personification of a blow dry, it's your mum.
And that's, she just has that natural bounce to her hair. She doesn't even blow dry it very much anymore.
Are you joking?
No, she's just like that. It's just who she is.
But, oh yes, so my funny shoes. I bought the shoes. Versace, thank you very much.
I was going to ask.
And I wore them. As you would, because you've bought something. I wore them, and then 4 days later, they had a tear in them. They were a nice little pair of loafers. So I obviously stopped wearing them, got on the phone straight to Donatella, and I was like, babe, what's happened to my shoes?
What fabric are these shoes, sorry, if they're tearing?
So it's a little red leather, like vinyl leather, loafer. However, you know, like on a loafer, it has the stitching around the top.
Yeah.
So it's like round the rim, like a pasty. And that's where the tears were. So I obviously was like, Donatella, what's going on here? You need to fire someone. And they emailed me back and were like, hello, Jamie, we can offer you a store credit or a replacement. And obviously in my head, relating back to our previous conversation about money, in my head I was like, God, that's free money. Even though it's literally not, because I've just spent the money on the shoes in the first place. But because they're like, you now have the same amount to spend again, in my head, it's a free purchase.
Did you spend more on the second pair, or did you buy the same ones?
So this will be a teaser. Suspense. I have booked in to go this weekend to deliberate on what I shall do, because I'm tempted to get the same pair, but you know what we're like, very fickle. I'm already bored of them slightly, so I might just get a new pair.
Because what I would do if someone gave me, and this is why I'm so bad with money, but I am getting better, but this is the kind of thing I do. So someone would give me a voucher, in which case I would then spend the price of the voucher on top of the voucher. Because as you said, free money. So I'll be like, well, I should therefore double the cost of the next shoe that I buy.
Oh yeah, because I've been given half price.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I would look at it.
Half price.
Sorry, absolutely. To your bank account.
Well, you know, I've got to spend that book money somewhere. And if it's on shoes.
Are you ready for a very beautiful segue?
Go on. I'm buckled in.
So, Jemay, if I were to be in your Versace shoes, walk me through what that might be like. Oh, wait, you don't need to, because you've written a book called In Their Shoes. It wasn't as neat as I was hoping. It was quite good.
That was delicious. You know, the best one I've done. best one I've done. What would a day in my shoes be? You know, at the moment, it's quite busy. I'll tell you that for nothing. It's hectic. It's managing a pandemic around trying to be, as you described, a cultural icon.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But at the moment, not to take a sour note on our beautiful conversation, but this summer has been a tricky one. It's been a difficult old slog for many reasons. And I won't go into them because otherwise we may have to add trigger warnings to the podcast, and that's never fun. But it's been a difficult one. And I think what's interesting is if you were in my shoes in like August, it would have been hard. And it was a very kind of difficult time mentally and kind of just the world pandemic wise was really stressful. I had lots of kind of personal stuff that was going on that I was like, and now I think it's a lot easier. I feel, you know, I've come out the other side of being within the kind of criminal system. Don't worry, dear listener, I was not arrested for public indecency again. But it's now, I feel almost like shaped by the experience, however, not in a way that means that I'm giving it power, but I feel like I have been able to shape how I come out to the other side.
Do you want to talk about it, or you don't want to talk about it?
I can do, yeah, because I am aware that it may be slightly non-contextual for listeners. Am I allowed to use all of the words?
You can use every single word that you want to use.
So this summer, I shared something online on Instagram that had happened to me, and it wasn't that nice an experience, and I think it was a very jarring experience. So I was raped during lockdown, which is not something that I expected to happen, and also, you know, no one ever really expects things like that to happen, but it was a very difficult situation to be in, purely for lots of reasons, obviously, but like I think for me it was kind of the aftermath of that, and being within the criminal justice system and being within a system that I just felt didn't fit me in any way. And I think when things like this happen, we obviously we have a lot of preconceptions of what the system is like from TV, from film, and a lot of that is not actually true. It's actually a lot more intense, and it's a lot more difficult. I think the only real depiction of it that I've seen that actually feels relevant or realistic is in, and I've now forgotten the programme, but it's that lovely new one that Michaela Cole did.
I May Destroy You.
I May Destroy You. Yeah. Yeah. And I watched that when it came out, and that was kind of a very, very realistic portrayal of what happens. And I think for me, it was just a lot to process. I just moved out on my own as well, so it was really kind of a whole kerfuffle, to be quite frank. And now, kind of 4 months on, I'm definitely through the worst of it. However, I think
that's why I love writing so much, is because, you know, I've noticed that during that time, I wasn't ever really listened to on a human level. I was only ever listened to share evidence. I was listened to provide resources rather than actually just like listened to on a human level. So to be able to write about it and to be able to put that out there, which I'm going to publish in November, was and has been really cathartic, because a lot of people for trans folks and marginalized bodies say that we know we shouldn't share our trauma constantly because it's trauma porn or because it's what's expected of marginalized bodies. But I think that obviously has a place and you should never be expected to. But if you decide to do something like that and share your story and you are in control of sharing that story, I think that is one of the most powerful things you can do. So, for example, for, like I say, for the next print issue of Gay Times, I have written what would have been my victim impact statement that I would have read out in court. So I have written that to be published, and it was completely my idea, completely my kind of motivation. I worked through to get to that idea from working with my therapist as part of my closure, and yeah, it's felt really nice, actually. I was really worried about doing it, but it's felt like I'm able to put the full stop on it rather than the police deciding when things end and when things are done. So for me, doing this is really, for me, it's me being selfish. It's me being able to control my narrative. So yeah, that's the context, if anyone was wondering. Yeah.
I don't think it's selfish. I think that, as you said, it's really important that when we feel that we have the power and we want to share something, that we are able to. I don't think that's selfish, because there will be always be someone who needs that story and who needs to read it. And there might be people who don't, but that's why we have trigger warnings, and that's why we have the ability to, you know, we've got to take ownership over what we need to absorb and digest and read. I don't think it's selfish, and I'm sure that it will be very impactful for lots of people in that who've been through those situations. So I wouldn't look at it like that. So what was the final outcome of the case?
So I reported the case the night of in June. And then in October, they basically were like, there is not enough evidence to go to trial. And basically what, in these cases, it's a very difficult, or as they describe it, it's apparently a very difficult crime to, what's the word?
Persecute,
because there doesn't just need to be evidence of it happening, but there needs to be tangible evidence that beyond no reasonable doubt, the person that is being accused understood that you had not consented, but still continued. And I remember I went to them in October for a meeting for them to basically sit down with me and explain why they've decided to not take it any further. And they were discussing the kind of difference between what socially we see as the definition of consent, which is obviously a definition that most of us understand and is kind of known, whereas the definition of consent in the criminal justice system is very, very different. And that was quite interesting to me, because, you know, you'd think that something like that would just have a definition and then you can carry it through and it would remain the same. But so the case was dropped. And I was basically told I can either take it to court myself through like civil court, or I can lay it to rest there. So I decided to just not move forward with it.
So what is the definition of consent in the criminal justice system then?
So they kind of explained it as it's obviously related and similar to the kind of social definition, but the difference in the criminal justice system is that consent has to be, there has to be proof that there is no consent. So there right. has to be a level of, it's very evidential. So there has to be evidence of the lack of consent. And I remember kind of joking to them. I was like, well, what do you want me to do? Like, do a voice note? Like, how was I supposed to, do you know what I mean? It's a very, unless it's like recorded, it's, or videoed in any way, it seems like a complete error to be like, how can you take that as evidence? In what way would I muster that?
Also, because it's one word against the other, and because even if you'd given consent in a voice note at the beginning of the act, you could change your mind halfway through. So that would be null and void anyway. And then if someone has, as you say, like violated you in a way that they've made that decision to do so, and they're saying you gave consent, like how are you going to have evidence for that? It does seem so problematic. Do you think it's harder? Did you find it harder as a non-binary person than you think it might be for someone who is cis or cis presenting? Like, what did you think that the process felt very different to you? You said earlier that you felt like you didn't fit the system, and I wondered if that was down to gender identity or.
This is fun, but by the way, I've not said this yet. So this is fun. I'm a bit scared, but I think it's fine.
Are you feeling that? Are you feeling okay?
Oh no, yeah, I feel fine talking about it. I'm just kind of. It just feels quite nice.
Oh, that's good.
What? Yeah, so kind of the feeling of me in the system as a non-cis person was very, kind of from the very beginning, it was very difficult. So as I reported the crime, officers arrived to me and I explained what had happened. And because of the nature of it being a same-sex situation, the two police officers basically were telling me that they didn't understand. They didn't have it. They were like, we don't have experience with this type of thing. We don't really understand what you mean, which was really odd. Because I was like,
what you meant about the actual violation, or what you meant about your own gender?
So they didn't understand some of the language that I was using around same sex, so like
right
two people of the same sex having sex. They just didn't understand the language that I was using, so for example, like top and bottom, or even like anal. They were like, I don't understand. I was like, right,
what? Okay.
They didn't understand, like, the I think that with queerness there's often we have more access to hookup culture. And when I tried to explain that it was just a hookup, they didn't understand that. So what they had to do was they called out, which at the time was not funny, but now thinking back, it is quite funny. They had to call out the special LGBT police officer come and essentially act as the translator to what was going on. So he arrived and talked to me, you know, spoke through it with me, and kind of literally I would say it to him, and then he would say it to the other officers, which I was just very, very baffled by. I did, in that instance with the LGBT officer, explain to him that I was non-binary, and I explained, and he was like, oh, that's fine. And then he turned to his colleagues and he was like, oh, by the way, guys, he's non-binary. And I was like,
he should have said they're non-binary, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So like there was a complete disregard. And then moving forward, kind of when I was working with the detectives and looking and kind of speaking about that, I tried to make sure that they understood my identity in relation to this crime, because I didn't like the idea of me being spoken about or written about in their reports in the wrong way. And it just was never really listened to. It was kind of, when I would bring it up, it was kind of reacted to with very defensive language, being like, we would never do that, we don't do that, we understand, but it's not intentional, all of these types of things. And then kind of in my final meeting, when I spoke with them about the decision, they still were using the wrong pronouns. And I think for me in that moment, I was like, right, I'm ready to leave this system now. I don't need to be in it. It's not going to benefit me. I'm actually glad it's not gone any further, because I think for me, being in the system was equally as bad as the incident itself.
I was about to say, it's just as traumatizing to be in a space where you're supposedly looking for help, and then the people there also are kind of committed to misunderstanding you and who you are. That's a really horrible space to be. And did you feel like you felt before this incident, did you have a bit more faith in how it would have played out, do you think?
I think the thing with this crime is I always knew that those types of crimes are never treated in a way that is proportionate to other crime. It's never that, you know, the conviction rate is very, very low. And I understand, just from kind of knowledge of, as a cultural commentator, that these situations are not dealt with to the end. So,
but did you expect, what I meant by that more was like, were you expecting to feel more safe going through the process than evidently you did?
I think one always feels like ringing any form of emergency service, your kind of main hope and aspiration there and aim is to be like, these people are going to look after me, these people are going to make me feel safe. But, you know, history and listening to lots of words, essentially, you know, this year has been highlighted that for Black folks and people of colour, that, you know, these institutions are not made for marginalised bodies, and they do not, there is never a guarantee that they're actually going to make you feel safe. And I think, unfortunately, that's what happened here. And that's what happens for so many marginalised people. So it was frustrating. I had lots of other kind of incidents with them over the past few months where it really made me think about the discussions around defunding the police.
I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. It just all of it sounds so traumatizing on top of each other. And I completely agree with, I was reading so much into the idea of like the abolition of the police and defunding them. And your brain really starts to like imagine a world with services that are applicable to the people that need them, rather than this police force, which actually like only really have one skill. They're not trained to be doing it. And actually it's more about kind of changing the way that we have this money put into people to look after us. You'd have a specific mental health paramedics type person that would come when you rang whatever number. And then you might have someone else who's good at dealing with domestic situations. And it's not about not having those people there at the end of the phone. It's about having the right people there. And I think that's where people get confused. They suddenly imagine like anarchy without police. And actually it's total opposite. It's still very much like there's a social justice system, but it's in a different means of, it's a different set of players rather than the wrong ones who don't know what they're doing, for want of a better phrase.
It was a very blanket situation.
And I think we're seeing it more and more, and especially with lots of trans charities as well that are losing funding, or that so many things are happening at the minute where there's being so many cuts to these really important lifelines for people. And I guess the hope is that with books like yours and voices who are able to hopefully puncture through some of the mainstream conversations that we see playing out in proper publications and also just on right-wing Twitter, that hopefully with like your voice being loud enough, it might give people access to why these things are so important. I think that so many times we just you're just not given the right space to talk about these issues. And I don't know what news channel you were on recently, but I always come back to like Piers Morgan's Good Morning Britain, and you just see the way that marginalized voices are kind of propped up as being I don't even know what the right word is, but they always have an agitator to play against this person who has is not the default voice, and it's just not good enough, and it's not good enough to help people understand why the status quo right now isn't helping people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, that kind of narrative, a lot of people claim, like the Piers Morgan narrative and the agitator kind of dynamic, they claim that it's very harmless, they claim it's in the essence of free speech. However, you know, I'm a very privileged person in the trans community, and this is how I was treated as a result of conversations that happen in right-wing news and on mainstream media. These conversations mean that the conversation is instantly and continually sidetracked and derailed in a way to focus on very minor issues, whereas actually, you know, there are situations like that I had that need more reform, but they are never spoken about because, you know, Piers Morgan wants to talk for an hour about foolishness to do with transness rather than the actual issues. And it screams to me that actually a lot worse is going on for less privileged trans folks in these systems. And it's frustrating.
I think it's the same that we see everywhere with this idea of, like, as you say, he'll get caught up in the idea of like women being spelt with an X for an hour, rather than talking about the fact that our National Health Service can't cater to certain people, or that we don't have adequate mental health training, as you said. And we see this the whole time where we have these kind of like culture wars, or these like really small peer-to-peer arguments being lauded as the issue, when actually the issue is much more systemic and legislative than any of these kind of like faux battles people have on Twitter. Because that's not really what anyone, like, that stuff doesn't really, it does matter in some ways, but if we fix the core of the issues, then hopefully those things on the top layer wouldn't happen.
Yeah, 100%. Because I think what then happens is, like, in my job as well as a writer and as a journalist, a lot of the time I'm asked to discuss topics or help consult on projects that are focused on these very minimal culture war moments, such as the woman with an X, or even kind of very, very, and I know it's an issue that people need safety for, but like changing rooms and bathrooms, like, these topics get so ingrained in conversation that actually, like we've said, the main crux of what actually we need help with is lost. And it also prevents people from actually doing the work and being active allies, because they see these conversations around these minimal issues, and then it kind of plays into the idea that trans people are just causing drama for drama's sake, when actually it's never trans people that bring these issues to the forefront, it's cis people. And then it's painted as trans folks constantly arguing for tiny little issues, when actually we never bring these issues up, we just are then asked to comment on them, and then it creates this dynamic of that we're just moaning all the time. And it's like, well, oh no.
How do you feel about, because I think we're in this moment of a lot of like virtue signaling and woke signaling, where just publications will, as you say, like ask you for your comment on something and then position themselves as progressive or part of the conversation, and actually then again, they're just feeding into the same thing. Like, do you think that that's moving forward? Is that changing? And like, because obviously, as we know, we need to have people, and you being contributing editor, that's the kind of important stuff, like people sat at the table rather than just doing a lip service on the pages, which serves more to the people at the top than it does to the people that it's supposedly catering for. Have you felt that we're in a position where things are changing, or is it still a lot of kind of lip service?
I think there is definite changes for example, like my role with Gay Times is a great opportunity for me to control a narrative in a way that allows me to share work that is joyful, and also it allows me to include voices from the non-binary community that aren't always shown, which I think is great. And it's like, it's what I call like by for journalism. It's by the community for the community. And I think when you have like little think pieces that crop up written by non-trans written by non-trans journalists, and they ask you for comment, sometimes it's helpful, because there is an element to conversations like that that are like, these words are going to go to an audience that don't necessarily engage with these conversations all the time. So therefore, if they can read a piece that is well written and has trans inclusion in it, then that's not always a bad thing. However, it does beg the question, should we have to be reading these little think pieces about bathrooms, about Woman X, about, you know, very, very small issues? You know, I'd rather see journalists ask me for comment on reform and actual positive changes, rather than should I be allowed to try a dress on in Urban Outfitters.
No, I completely agree. And I think that's where even I am starting to realize that sometimes even some of the conversations I have end up being quite surface level, because whilst it is important, I feel like our generation, perhaps more than ever, are so we're really pernickety and we want to do things right, and so we are concerned about some of the small stuff, because we're like trying to do everything from the ground up, like we want to get things right. But then at the same time, it's like when it's coming down to what's actually fundamentally going to have the biggest change, it has to come from systems and legislation. I've sometimes realized that I don't tackle enough of that gritty bigger stuff, because you can go around for hours and hours just talking about identity and identity politics, and sometimes that again feeds into the idea that, you know, there's not a bigger conversation to be had beyond that, when there always kind of is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as long as people are beginning to acknowledge that and realize that there's always a wider conversation, I'm hopeful for the future of journalism.
So in your book, how much of it would you say is like instructive or educational? Is it a really witty approach at just going like, this is who I am and this is what I'm like, as opposed to being as activist as perhaps some of your other work?
I've never really aligned with that, with the activist phrase. And I think I speak about it in the book about how often when marginalized people just speak about their experiences, they're called an activist, whereas actually in the book I try and debunk that slightly and also showcase my stories through kind of wit and humor, and try and avoid and almost take the piss out of like live, laugh, love and just do it and all of these kind of mantras. Because often when you read books that are supposed to give you advice, it's very much like, you can do it. And it's like, yeah, I know I can, babe, but like, it's not my fault if the world around me isn't letting me. So each chapter has kind of a list in each chapter of like 10 things I would say to a non-binary person about, and then it's each chapter is about the theme. So like 10 things I'd say to someone wanting to explore fashion, or 10 things I'd say to someone about how to deal with their mental health. So there is practical advice in there, but I think, unfortunately, the kind of initial reviews that came in have said that it does feel very like practical and realistic. It's not super like rainbows and, you know, glitter everywhere. It's very like gritty and honest, but in a way that's hopefully relatable to people.
Yeah, and I think it's important to be able to, you know, as you were saying earlier, like to be able to tell your story and not sugarcoat things and not try to make people feel comfortable, or, you know, it's got to be truthful, I think. And I think that it will be funny knowing you. I imagine that it's going to be absolutely hilarious because you're a funny honey. What can I say?
Well, if you've listened to this and you've let out a slight exhalation through the nose, then like that, then you then, you know, you like it. Also, I know this isn't something that should... Someone said this to me the other day, like, Jamie, you should not say that to try and sell your book, but it is only 200 pages. So, you know, you could whip through it in like a week. That's a couple of tube journeys.
I think that is a massive thing for people because I love reading anyway, but lots of people that don't read always ask me to get really intimidated. People do just prefer a short book because also I think our concentration span at the minute with everything that's going on, it's actually really hard to stick to something that's too thick. So something that's like manageable, 200 pages is a really good amount, is actually much more alluring than like a massive, chunky, fat book.
And it's got a picture of me on the back, so...
Oh, love. Well, the last thing, which I didn't prepare you for because we did this, so we organised this in such a slapdash manner, love, was that I meant to ask you, but so I can give you a bit of time if you need to think about it, but at the end of every episode this season, I'm asking people what their three favourite books are, but obviously they don't have to be your all-time favourites. They could be like your favourites right now or like childhood book, anything. Do you have a top three books for me?
Okay, so I'm looking at my bookshelf as we speak.
Love.
And I would say a book that I read last year that I read, I then kind of went back to currently because it was... the content was relatable, is Know My Name by Chanel Miller, which is a book from the sexual assault victim of Brock Turner, which is an amazing read. And it's all about her process through the system. You know, it was a very high profile case, so it talks about her situation. So I found that really lovely, if it can be called lovely. I have just started reading Sophie Hagen's wonderful book, Happy Fat, which I'm thoroughly enjoying.
So I'd say that.
That's currently up there as a number one. And then, because I've not read for a while... but I have started reading recently. Finally, I would say I got sent my lovely friend Henry James Garrett's book called This Book Will Make You Kinder. And Henry is an amazing illustrator and writer. And he actually, on a personal note, kind of, you know, I'm sure you know what this is like. We have people online that we kind of are mildly friends with, but we don't have that much of a solid friendship. But over summer and when I was kind of dealing with my stuff, he reached out and has been like a real rock for me, essentially, and a real lovely person. So his book is called This Book Will Make You Kinder, and it's all about it's called an empathy handbook. So it takes a look at social definitions of like morality, how we define what's moral and immoral, and how that can influence why we are kind and why we help other people. And it's full of all of his gorgeous illustrations, and I love him. So those are my three. Also, fourth is In Their Shoes by Jamie Windass.
I love that. I'm really excited about that third one. I'm going to look that up because I haven't heard of that. But that's all so fab. I can't believe how quick off the mark you are. I'm very impressed.
Thank you.
So you didn't have any pre-warning. So yes, thank you so much for joining me. I've loved this chat. Did it get a bit sad? Are you okay?
So it did get a bit sad. And I've not shared that information publicly. However, I wouldn't have said it if I didn't want it to be said. So I feel happy.
Well, thank you for sharing with me.
That's okay, my love. It was nice to laugh about it.
If people don't yet follow you on social media, where can they find you apart from Wimbledon?
First of all, I would say, what are you doing, silly? Do not look up your personal Instagram before you start listening. I always do. But on Instagram, you can find me at Jamie
@Jenny_WinDust, like winning and like dust, but one word. And that's the same on Twitter. And my book, In Their Shoes, is available to pre-order on Amazon, Waterstones, and your local independent bookshop, where they have signed copies if you want to scribble from me.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for joining me and chatting and lolling and sharing.
Thank you, my love. I love you.
Love you. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Bye.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.